Welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer, producer and host of this program, and it's good to be with you. Comic book characters have been appearing on the big screen for decades, with the latest example, Avengers Endgame, coming out last month. Comic books and their Japanese counterpart manga have also served as a place for writers and artists to tackle complex issues. This week we are listening to a humanities symposia from Trine University, and the speaker is Patrick Ridout, Assistant Director of Information Services at Trine University's Link Library. Ridout is a comic book fan and collector, and we'll hear from him in a moment for The Mighty Atom, Nuclear Energy in Comics and Manga. Please enjoy the show.
First of all, I probably do read too many comics. I have almost 2,000 in my collection currently, so probably too many at this point. So you just heard, my name is Patrick Ridout. I'm here to kind of talk to you about comics in the nuclear age today, which is a pretty fascinating topic. A couple of things to note right beforehand. One, I may mispronounce words, mispronounce names especially, because some of these, I don't know how they're pronounced. I've only ever seen them on paper. So I'm sorry for that. Secondly, if you see anything that you feel is missing from this talk, if you read something and you remember something and you're like, that should have been in there, come talk to me, because maybe I left it out, or maybe I don't know about it yet, because this research is ongoing. So as I continue to write this, this will expand, this will move forward. So if you guys, you know, have any opinions of your own, please feel free to reach out to me. My office is in the link. You can come talk to me at any point. So let's just get started. I'm going to talk to you about nuclear comics. And if my clicker's on here. There we go. So a couple of questions before we begin. I kind of started out here, and this is where my research kind of took me. How comics influenced developing opinions of nuclear energy, both in weapons and in power. How did these opinions change as facts emerged and, you know, the technology became more readily available? We gained more information in the public sphere about, you know, how nuclear physics worked. And then, of course, how did the dual nature of both positives and negatives affect the outcome and opinions in comics, both from the public sphere to comics and from comics to the public sphere? So we're going to kind of consider those while we go through these. I'm going to hit on a few major topics here. One, we're going to talk about weapons. Everybody knows about weapons. You probably already know most of what I'm going to talk about, at least opinion-wise. Americans' opinions on nuclear weapons and Japan's opinions on nuclear weapons, because these are the two major markets, right? You have Japanese manga, you have American comics, generally. We do have a European market, but they're not as relevant to the discussion in nuclear topics. And then we're going to move on to power. We're going to talk about America's shift when nuclear energy kind of came home and it's set up in its backyard. And then we're going to talk about Japan's continued resistance to anything nuclear-related. We had a article from a politician who once called it a nuclear allergy in Japan. So let's get started on weapons. For those of you who don't know, this is a shot from Barefoot Gen. We'll talk about that in just a second. But so when it appeared in World War II, this is kind of the first public appearance of nuclear anything, of atomic energy, of atomic weapons, of atomic anything. People really didn't have any idea what was going on, what it meant. You know, all they knew is that it was kind of a very powerful force that could do a lot of damage or do a lot of mysterious things. And in fact, comics were actually some of the first adopters to use atomic energy as a storyline, right? Comics actually use atomic energy as a plot device. And it's first started in government censorship. For those of you who were here last time, you may recognize a couple of these slides here. The U.S. government actually stepped in during World War II to censor comics because in 1945, about 4 months before, 4 months before or after, we're not quite sure because of the censorship records, Superman actually came up with a storyline where Lex Luthor created an atomic beam and an atomic bomb. This was right around the same time that we dropped it on Japan in World War II. So the U.S. government stepped in 1945 and said, you can't publish that. That's not good. It basically opened up with Superman and Lois Lane discovering a, you know, mess. Something had destroyed everything. The trees were bent and, you know, boulders broken and all this other stuff. And Superman discovers that he's invented an atomic beam, and he later nearly destroys Superman with an atomic bomb. This is back in 1945. And by the way, we only know about these because Times and Newsweek kind of did an in-depth article on the censorship during World War II and found these and kind of brought them to light. That's the only way we really know about these. Another one was Crime Paradise in 1946, where Superman actually filmed a video of an atomic bomb test for the U.S. military. This was actually commissioned by the Army, so it's actually slightly a propaganda comic as well. But it was then eventually canceled because there wasn't actually a topic that was commissioned by the government about nuclear anything that wasn't later canceled for about 3 decades. We started seeing it in the 1960s when we finally kind of got uncensored. You know, as Newsweek said, while Superman could withstand a 3 million volt bombardment from a cyclotron, he couldn't stand the Office of Censorship. The War Department would actually go through and clear out all those storylines. So with the onset of the nuclear age, we see Marvel and DC kind of fight for this storyline. And for a while, we didn't see much, right? We got all the censorship, we got all this stuff. But in the 1960s, particularly 1961, 1962, 1963, we started seeing characters show up that had direct links to nuclear energy. Starting with Fantastic Four in 1961. Now, granted, it was called cosmic rays and they were in space at the time, but there's a very clear distinction between what we were starting to see from, you know, Japan and the effects that we were starting to see from the nuclear bombs that we had dropped and the Fantastic Four. We started seeing, you know, some people got and gained great superpowers and became very popular. This is the mysterious part of nuclear energy. And then others would become actual monsters. It's a little on the nose, some of these earlier comics, really. There's a very direct correlation between the two. It's a very mysterious force, some sort of radiation that came through and warped everybody. Furthermore, even more blatantly, in Fantastic Four number 4, the Submariner comes back. For those of you who were here last time, you may remember that the Submariner was one of the superheroes Marvel sent over to punch Nazis in the face during World War II, and he was kind of treated as a hero there. Now he's back to being an antagonist. And the reason why he's an antagonist is because the U.S. has been performing nuclear tests on his hometown. Submariner lives under the sea. Guess where we decided to do all of our nuclear tests? Off the coast of islands and things like that. So he comes up and starts attacking America, starts attacking the Fantastic Four because of the accursed atomic tests of the humans. And then, of course, how they solve it is the Thing straps a nuclear bomb to his back and tries to blow up the Submariner. Nobody died. This is the 1960s in American comics that nobody dies ever. So, but he somehow survived. But the Thing is able to survive nuclear blasts officially, just in case you were wondering that. A couple of others. One, the Hulk. You all were probably thinking about that when you first came in. You know, nuclear radiation. Of course, it's the Hulk, right? He's big. He's green. Actually, he used to be gray. But originally in 1962, there was even a more direct correlation because how many of you knew right off the bat that the Hulk was actually sabotaged by a Soviet spy in his nuclear energy and nuclear reactor tests instead of, you know, this gamma radiation, you know, I created an experiment that turned me green and angry. Originally, he was sabotaged directly with a nuclear test. A couple of others, the Beast and Sunfire from the X-Men. Some of you may think, you know, well, there's only 2 X-Men here. Well, that's actually kind of the case. Most mutations from the X-Men come from genetic mutations, come from, you know, powers from other places. There are 2 major ones that came into play with the Beast and Sunfire with direct connection with nuclear power. The Beast, his parents were exposed by working on nuclear reactors, and that's why he gains his superpowers. Some of you may not recognize him. Picture him blue and furry. This is his original form before he turned into basically, you know, a giant furball that we kind of all know today. And then Sunfire was created because his mother was exposed to Hiroshima. And his powers are a little on the nose. He blows up and catches on fire. That's a little on the nose there. But switching over, and we're going to switch back and forth between America and Japan here a few times. I want to talk about Barefoot Gen, Keiji Nakazawa, and kind of the anti-nuclear sentiment that kind of grew out of Barefoot Gen as a whole. Barefoot Gen is the harshest version of any nuclear comic that I've found so far. It is completely unflinching in its accusatory states. It shows everything. It is a 2,510-volume set about post-war Japan. And it takes place, it's actually semi-autobiographical. The creator of this series actually survived the Hiroshima bomb drop. He's actually quoted in his official biography as saying that the person he was talking to was basically turned into like char dust, and he survived because he was up against the concrete wall of the school at the time. This obviously makes him very, very anti-nuclear, right? You see the destruction, you see the misery it caused, and it kind of forces your opinion on these things. And for his entire life, he basically spent his entire life trying to denuclearize things, fighting for all that stuff. He formed a group called Project Gen, which is actually responsible for Barefoot Gen being one of the first manga ever translated into English. There are a couple right before it, just a few, but this is actually one of the first translated manga into English. And it literally pulls absolutely no punches. It talks about, laying the blame at America's feet, laying the blame at Japan's feet. It's actually widely criticized on both sides because of its depictions of these things. It talks about, and it doesn't just talk about, the nuclear radiation fallout. And you can see, I realize these panels are a little disturbing, but you can see what I'm talking about here, where he did not want to shy away from showing what actually happened. But he takes a look at the war, including poverty, sickness, famine, all of the additional just junk that started happening at the end of it. This actually is still one of the most challenged books in America and abroad, because in America, it's kind of obvious, right? It's anti-American, it's too violent, it's not age-appropriate because comics are for children a lot of times, right? That's a common misconception. But it's not age-appropriate, there's too much sexual content, all this other stuff. In Japan, it's actually challenged on a regular basis simply because he criticizes the Japanese government. And he acknowledges the atrocities that Japan committed within World War II, as well as, the Americans are to blame for all this other stuff. He talks about, the racism against Koreans and what happened in Nanking and all these other aspects. So this is actually constantly challenged. And just a couple of years ago, it was banned from an entire school district for about 6 months because this continues to happen. This is an ongoing issue. So I just want you guys to kind of consider that. And this is another thing that I wanted to slightly hit on. We have a lot of political cartoons. We know political cartoons, but their political cartoons being censored by the War Office, being censored by the U.S. occupation of Japan, very few of these have survived. And there's a ongoing project to find these critical comics about criticizing America, criticizing the Japanese government, because they have been lost for so long. This is one of the few that survived, and it's actually been translated already. You can see the preschool stupeducation. I think that's how you pronounce it. But it's talking about we'll provide the teaching materials, and they're teaching him the profits of war and the education of war instead of anything actually useful. So I want to move on because this kind of leads into energy. Energy is a big ongoing debate, right? We still hear about it today. Nuclear reactors are everywhere. It's an ongoing debate. And the reason why I needed to establish the war aspects of nuclear power before we talk about energy is because people confuse the two. A lot of times, even people in this room, even I do this, where we confuse nuclear energy with nuclear weapons, We confuse power with, you know, weapons of war. So we'll talk a little bit about that, because that is one of the prevailing theories as to, you know, why we don't have a more, you know, pro-nuclear stance, is because we kind of confuse the two all the time. And we'll talk about how that happens. It was pushed positively for a time, and then it landed very firmly in the anti-nuclear camp. Let's talk about propaganda. Propaganda for children. Starting in the 1950s, 1960s, right around the time that censorship starts to be a little more lax on this stuff, we start to see propaganda being produced by the different governments. We start to see some of the companies come out and start talking about, you know, how good nuclear energy is, right? We start to see things like Inside the Atom. This was actually produced by General Electric. We start to see, you know, government collections actually being created for a pro-nuclear stance. And we see this also with a lot of mascots. We see mascots come out, you know, talk about, you know, the good power of nuclear energy, the future. It's going to be this never-ending source of energy that we can do so much with. However, because we named them the same thing, we named atomic energy and we named atomic bombs the same thing, basically, this gets confused because we have the Cold War starting to ramp up at this time. So we have this whole, you know, duck and cover. The USSR is going to come and blow up, you know, all the U.S. cities. What to do in the event of a nuclear attack? We have Bert the Turtle. For those of you who are a little older in the audience, may remember this as being, you know, kind of the mascot character for hide under your desk in case of a nuclear attack. And because we reinforce this over and over and over again that, you know, the atomic bomb is coming, the atomic bomb is coming, when you approach atomic energy, it sounds like the exact same thing, and it's often used with the same symbols, right? You still see that atom, that swirling atom symbol, all the time for both subject matter. So with this, we're starting to see this kind of melding of the subject, even though they're separate. And a lot of the engineers in the room are probably going, well, of course they're separate. Of course they are. But to the public's opinion, we're not seeing that. We're starting to see it kind of smashed together. And we also see this happen with propaganda comics getting snuck under and people trying to get away with putting out pro-nuclear stances and not trying to acknowledge it. This is one of the few that actually still exists anymore, known as the Great Tokyo Blackout, which is a storyline where, you know, all the coal plants stop working in Tokyo, and Tokyo goes into complete blackout mode, and nobody has any energy. And the way they save it is they find this, you know, alternative fuel that, you know, will power the city for eternity and all this other stuff. Well, this is one of the few comics that's actually been directly linked and proven to be paid for by one of the pro-nuclear groups. It's actually one of the only ones that we've found, one of the only surviving ones, I guess I should say. There's not many of these that still survive. You can kind of tell from the scan quality that it's a little rough, but this was actually paid for by a pro-nuclear company, you know, to try and kind of push their opinions on everyone else. So we did see things like this that kind of, you know, throws the whole conversation into the mix. So let's talk about one of the big ones, which you probably all saw as the icon for this talk, the Mighty Atom, or Astro Boy, as he would be known outside of Japan. Astro Boy was a character in 1952 that was created, and he was called the Mighty Atom. He's called Astro Boy here because actually, for a very ridiculous reason, they think that it may be because they were considering names, and they were like, wait, the Mighty Atom, isn't that like a minor Marvel character? We don't want to get into copyright trouble. So they named him Astro Boy because he kind of has the same, you know, futuristic power energy to the name. And ever since then, it's been Astro Boy outside of Japan. You go to any other country and you'll find Astro Boy merch. Some of you may actually recognize this. He's pretty recognizable, to be perfectly honest. But it's actually, in retrospect, very good that they changed the name, because as it was gaining popularity in America, the Cold War was starting to ramp up, and anti-nuclear issues and the movements and everything else were coming into, you know, their full strength at this time, which basically would have caused major issues for him down the line, because everybody would have confused it with atomic energy, because Astro Boy is actually run by a nuclear reactor. So, and, you know, Tezuka just likes to say that, you know, he came up with the name Atom because everybody was doing atom bomb tests at the time, and everybody was talking about the atom and what the atom could do. So he just used atom as kind of a filler word. The same way we kind of use quantum in sci-fi right now, you always hear about, you know, quantum everything in case they just need a filler word for science. Atom was that word in the 1950s, 60s, 70s. You know, it could pretty much do anything. But he absolutely hated nuclear weapons because, obviously, you know, he survived the nuclear bomb drops. He didn't survive it in the same way Nakazawa did, but he did survive and serve in the military and all that fun stuff. So he absolutely hated nuclear weapons. But he decided to use atomic energy and show what was possible. So he created this peaceful continent called the Atom Continent, where, you know, all the nuclear energy and all the nuclear talks were actually peaceful. You know, it powered cars, it powered homes, you know, it powered a little robot that, you know, stood for the good in people, you know. And Astro Boy's whole thing is that he's a robot who slowly learns to become human. He slowly becomes, you know, connected to his feelings. He becomes more sympathetic along the line. And, you know, he kind of represents the good in humanity, right? Even though he's a robot. there's actually a direct correlation between Atom and Superman, because Mighty Mouse was actually the connector, because Mighty Mouse was a parody of Superman, right? He was kind of a cartoonish, childish version of Superman with the distinctive headpiece, which, if you notice about Astro Boy, there's a distinctive headpiece for him. And he's actually always drawn that way. No matter which way the camera is facing for every panel, he always has the two. It's never straight on. So something to consider. It's the same thing that Mighty Mouse did. You'll never see that straight on shot of it. And that's the reason why Tezuka says he's based on Mighty Mouse. But he's cited as being, you know, the possibilities. What nuclear energy could do if you know, it was possible and we got away from the weapon part. Also, some stories actually directly dealt with nuclear energy. We had this particular story that you see in front of you was actually based on, you know, all the animals came through and there's a new ice age coming through and they're all in trouble. And so Astro Boy saves the day by building a nuclear reactor that warms up the land and saves the day. And you can see, like, all of his talking animal friends down there. But Astro Boy, since 1952, has been a major driving force. However, there is a stipulation for this. Astro Boy has been rewritten quite a few times, actually. As the anti-nuclear movement kind of became much more powerful, they started challenging Tezuka. Why is he, you know, powered by a nuclear reactor? That's bad. No matter what, that's bad, right? And so he actually would have to come out in public and say, you know, I don't like nuclear power plants either. I don't want it. And in fact, it got so bad after a while, he started kind of walking that back. It went from a nuclear fusion reactor to a nuclear fission reactor, which was a little more, you know, clean technology and doesn't have as much waste. And then in the 1980s, he completely rewrites it, and now he only has a reactor that just needs heavy water, which is just kind of an offshoot of whatever's produced, right? And so Astro Boy, while he started out with a nuclear reactor, and in the original comics, if you read those, in the original manga, you'll see he's always powered by a nuclear reactor. But ever since the 1980s, we've seen him walk it back and be rewritten. So let's move back to America, because we're in the middle of the Cold War now, right? We're in the 1960s, 1970s. And Captain America is no longer smashing Nazi skulls, he's smashing commies. You know, Captain America commie smasher, and he just, you know, attacks the red and everything else. And he this sentiment becomes kind of the prevailing theory now. We see the nuclear conversation pick up with not only with Captain America, but in the real world, we start to see it come home. We start to see the nuclear conversation come home because we start building nuclear. We don't just build nuclear weapons. We start, you know, considering we're going to build some nuclear power plants now. This goes back to that propaganda stuff. So, you know, nuclear weapons held in the same view as nuclear energy at this point. Still is. But America doesn't really like it when it shows up in its own backyard at this point. And so we start to see American propaganda show up in the other direction now. We start to see, you know, anti-nuclear sentiment appears almost immediately. And you can kind of see in the way they word it, you know, is nuclear power the answer? Kit, I'd bet your life on it. I'd bet your life, not my life. So up until recently, at this point in time, atomic energy was, you know, still considered this mysterious force. Well, I don't want that mysterious force in my backyard. That's not what I want. And with groups like NIMBY, which is not in my backyard, they basically dove directly into the anti-nuclear movement at this point. You can kind of see from this chart, because in 1979, Three Mile Island happened. For those of you who remember that, one of the biggest nuclear meltdowns in American history. And you can see anti-nuclear sentiment basically became a much bigger issue. This positivity, it was up near 70% in 1977, and going on down, it's never risen above 60% at this point. It's never been in the majority ever since Three Mile Island. So comics, which often reflect the, you know, current world, the current dynamic of whatever political sphere they're in, comics immediately start reflecting this. And we start seeing things happen. We start seeing, remember how I was talking about the Thing being the representation of nuclear energy and being able to survive a nuclear blast? Well, now he's anti-nuclear. Now he's coming to, you know, save the day from the reactor blowing up. And quite frankly, I believe this is a gentleman who was fired from the plant and decided to take everybody else with him. But we also see people like Black Zero appear, who rewrote, this is Black Zero, this big bald guy. He's not Lex Luthor like some of you probably assumed. But Black Zero blew up Krypton. And he blew up Krypton with a nuclear bomb and nuclear reactors. And now he's coming to do the same to Earth now. And oh, look, we've got all these great little nuclear reactors on the planet that we can also use to blow up the Earth. So we start to see DC and Marvel, kind of the two points on the map that we always kind of judge by, because indie comics are always all over the place. Marvel and DC always reflect this, you know, current trends in the political sphere. So we start to see Marvel and DC immediately just switch over. They were all pro-nuke, and then all of a sudden, no, we're anti-nukes, to the point where we're rewriting backstories like Superman's, and it's no longer, you know, Krypton fell into the sun or had a black hole or, you know, whatever you're talking about. It's now, no, it was destroyed by nuclear weapons. And this storyline in particular kind of carried over into the Superman 4 Request for Peace movie, for anybody who's seen that. We don't talk about it very much, but yeah. That's kind of where it happened. And it kind of culminates in where a lot of these theories and issues of superhero comics kind of culminate, which is Watchmen in the 1980s. Height of the Cold War, it's an alternative history Cold War, and it talks about, Watchmen basically talks about the realities of what these characters would actually be like. You know, what if someone, you know, dressed up as an animal and went around beating up criminals in the middle of the night? Well, that man is a sociopath. In our world, that man is a sociopath. Batman is a crazy person. So in Watchmen, it deals with these things. And for the nuclear question, we have Dr. Manhattan, who is the only superhero in the entire storyline, by the way. He's the only one with actual powers. Dr. Manhattan, first of all, Manhattan Project. He's a nuclear scientist turned nuclear-powered superhero. And in fact, he kind of represents the entire conversation. Right? They treat him in the storyline as a nuclear weapon, as the fear and the power of the U.S. He goes to Vietnam and he wins Vietnam, almost single-handedly, right? And he's a little on the nose, right? He's got the hydrogen symbol emblazoned on his forehead. He's called Dr. Manhattan. And the first time we ever see him in the comic, he's powering the electrical grid. He's kind of the representation of the entire conversation at this point. But ever since then, and we'll come back to this a little bit, ever since then, we've not seen a whole lot of nuclear talk, right? Since the Cold War died down and the conversation has died down, we've seen comics kind of move on. We've started to see, you know, in the last 20 years, we've had comics dealing with terrorism mostly, right? That's the big thing. Ever since 9/11, we've had terrorists as kind of the central plot for a lot of our media. However, I do believe that with all the additional talk in the current political sphere, we're going to start seeing an uptick again. You know, we're going to start seeing it because, you know, the U.S. and Russia have withdrawn from the nuclear pact. And we've seen, you know, the posturing from North Korea or India or Pakistan or any of the other nuclear powers that are kind of showing up and kind of bristling together. And everybody's kind of afraid of that conversation right now. So I believe we're going to see an uptick in comics, especially in the conversation. It's going to probably come back. I do want to talk about the anti-nuclear movement in Japan for a little bit to catch you up the same way I just caught you up with America. So this first statement right here is false. Remember how I've been talking about anti-nuclear movements and anti-nuclear sentiment the whole time? This one claims that prior to the 1990s, it existed, but it was on the fringe. And I've been trying to track down who actually wrote this because it's kind of unsourced. But the thing that caught my eye was left-wing groups and local trade associations. So I decided to look into that. First of all, the trade associations weren't necessarily the traditional trade associations that you would think of. So these were actually women's groups that came through and were at the forefront of the anti-nuclear movement. And it's not for a fear of the power. It's not for a fear of the radiation. These spawned out of land grabs from, you know, a company would come in and be like, this village is in the way, we're gonna buy the land, we're gonna throw all the people out and build a nuclear reactor on top of it. And that's what we're gonna do. Well, these women's groups who, you know, were formed because at that point in time, you know, women weren't in the workforce. The men would go off to their jobs. The children would go off to school. They would create, you know, big communities. And these women groups would basically become the staple block for these companies who would come in and be like, we're going to buy the land. Well, no, you're not. So these actually showed up. And in the 1960s and through the 1990s, Japan had a big boom on nuclear energy, right? We talk about, you know, the opposition, but they didn't have much of an effect. They just kind of ran with it. And by the end of the 90s, Japan actually had 51 operational reactors at the time. And in the 90s, we also see a massive amount of upset, a massive amount of disasters, mishaps, all sorts of stuff. And some of you are probably thinking of the more recent one with Fukushima, but we had a lot of those beforehand as well. But despite that, you know, the anti-nuclear movement didn't really gain a whole lot of traction until these mishaps started to happen. In particular, Kazuhiko Miyaya, I told you I was going to butcher these names, was actually, you know, pushing a very dark and gritty and pulpy style of storytelling. We actually have one, I didn't bring it here, but it's a story about a pearl diver who survives her husband, and she survives drowning by the pro-nuclear movement. The pro-nuclear movement basically hired a bunch of Yakuza to come in and kill everybody in the village, and they thought they drowned her, and then she didn't because she's a pearl diver, she can hold her breath. So she basically spends the next 200 to 300 pages of the story just going around murdering people. This is the 1960s and 70s. This was, you know, pulp was what we get. But it invaded even, you know, the most, like, low-brow style of storytelling. But you know, Miyaya and Mizuki, and those of you paying attention should know this name, because he's one of the biggest names in the whole industry. Shigeru Mizuki basically wrote the book on a whole bunch of different topics, but he also wrote the book on anti-nuclear sentiment. He talked about, and he was a staunchly anti-nuclear power person, and he wrote these stories, and you can kind of tell from looking at this panel in particular, your brain starts to notice things and starts to see things out of the corner of your eye. And he draws it in this way because he's talking about, you know, the loneliness and the alienness of the nuclear power plant. In particular, they like to focus on what are called nuclear gypsies, who, that's a loose translation, but basically they're drifters who would go to a nuclear reactor, work until they had too much radiation, and then leave for either the year for the people who were following the rules, or they would drift to the next nuclear reactor and, you know, say, oh yeah, I'm clear, and fake documents and keep working. And they wanted to tell stories about these people who kind of drifted in and out of the nuclear facilities and, you know, talk about the alienness of the technology and talk about, you know, well, even though we're working in it, we don't really understand it, and these things are very alien and kind of horrific, and you can kind of get like an H.E. Geiger kind of thing, H.R. Geiger off of this artwork here, but you know, he wanted to talk about these, you know, kind of disturbing elements. And then, of course, we come to Fukushima Devilfish. This is not Fukushima as we know it. This is Fukushima in the 1960s and 1970s. Written by Katsumata Susumu. I hope I pronounced that right. This is of particular importance because this anti-nuclear gentleman was a nuclear scientist. He had his master's degree in nuclear engineering. So he had this perspective that nobody else had. And remember how I said we kind of confuse the two, weapons and energy? This collection has no nuclear weapon talk in it. But you can see right at the very top, that's probably the Enola Gay, and that's probably Hiroshima. That's this only talks about, you know, nuclear stories and nuclear power plants. It doesn't talk about that, but yet it's on the front cover. So it's something to kind of consider, and he kind of used his artistic vision to kind of show you what happens with the radiation. And one can be left to interpret what this actually means. Either that's, you know, markings from him being banged around in the storyline, or it could be the radiation, because as you can see, as people work, they gain more and more little dots, but by the end, they're full-blown flower petals. So it's kind of a symbolic issue, but he really liked to talk about, you know, the alienness of the power plant, and, you know, the fear and the loneliness. And I guess I should clarify, Fukushima devilfish just means Fukushima octopus. A devilfish is just an octopus. So, but he likes to, you know, you can kind of see the similarities between the two panels. You get this, you know, bottom of the sea feeling. You get the loneliness of them being kind of isolated in this alien world that really nobody really knew about. But additionally, he liked to kind of demystify it. He liked to talk about the workers. He didn't just want to acknowledge, you know, the alienness of the nuclear power plant and, you know, the weirdness of the technology and the dangers of everything. He also liked to talk about just everyday stuff, right? So this panel read right to left, so you would go one page and then you'd go the second page, is actually just a two-page story about a guy who was working in the nuclear power plant who needed to go to the bathroom. And this is the process he had to go through the entire time. So he kind of, you know, he has to run outside. He has to get decontaminated, take care of all his decontaminated clothes, get tested on all sorts of things, sign out, get dressed, run down, get tested, run down all the way to the very end of the road where the bathroom waits. So you can kind of see that he wanted to talk about not just, you know, the mysteries and everything else and the horror of the nuclear power plant, but also just, you know, acknowledge the humanity of the people working in it. As well, I put up a couple of charts and graphs for you guys to kind of give you an idea of where we've landed in Japan with the nuclear, how people feel about nuclear power. First of all, I just put this up because this kind of gives you an idea of how people trust public institutions, which is not very much. You know, you can see politicians get 2% trust, 2% trust for bureaucrats, things like that. And this adds into this, which is the trust in nuclear energy, which you can see the trust is always around 30%, 30 to 40%. Everybody else, they don't trust it very much. In fact, you know, 42% say they outright disagree with supporting nuclear powers. 53% don't trust the nuclear policy. And this is, granted, this is before the big one that just happened a few years ago. This was in 1999. The big one, of course, being Fukushima. We talk about Fukushima devilfish. That was from the 1970s. This is Fukushima as it is today. You all may remember this from just a few years ago in 2011 when it happened. But Fukushima has been turned into this, you know, horrific nightmare in the news, right? We've all heard, you know, very extreme views on everything. And I wanted to talk a little bit about a manga called Itchy F, which it just means one F, which is the tower that melted down in Fukushima. It's the one that broke. And this is the double page spread from the comic itself. But it's written by a gentleman who basically is a nuclear gypsy. He's a legal nuclear gypsy in that he adheres to the radiation requirements. As soon as he hits the radiation requirements, he's done for the year. He doesn't break any laws like some do. But he goes through and he cleans up the nuclear power plant. He's not an engineer. He's just a cleaner. He's one of the people who have come in since the plant's meltdown, and they're working to clean up all of the disaster that is Fukushima. It's written, you know, it basically didn't have anything good or bad to say about the place. The way he worded it is that he wanted to fill a gap. There was a gap in the media. There's either, you know, this is the end of the world, or, you know, nuclear energy can be, you know, the greatest thing ever made, right? You know, it represents everything that's possible. But he wanted to fill in this gap that seemed to be missing of the humanity of just the normal people in the cleanup crew, where, you know, he felt like there was a gap in people's understanding. He is actually anonymous. He uses a pseudonym because he actually goes back and works on it still. Every year, he goes back and makes another journey to it. But actually, this is a very large outlier because we actually had a first print run of 150,000 copies. That doesn't happen, especially for a brand new author. This is his only work. So this was something that caught the attention of the entire public. This is something that's become part of the conversation because it's included the humanity of normal people. It's included, you know, him, you know, nearly running over a cow while he's trying to, you know, drive to work, or, you know, talking about, you know, the simple everyday lives of the people in the cities that still have risk, but people are starting to come back. He talks about, you know, just the everyday occurrence. Here's the process I have to go through every time I have to enter the plant. You know, and it's a 27-step process talking about, you know, how he has to, like, seal his mask and, you know, which masks are better and which one he prefers and all these other things. And it brings you back home from just the, you know, out and out, oh, no, it's a terrible thing, or, oh, no, it's, or, you know, oh, good, it's the best thing ever made. And it kind of brings back home the humanity of the people actually working on this. You know, he says, you know, we hear a lot of what the media wants you to hear. You know, it talks about the water storage problem. It talks about, you know, the removal of the fuel assemblies. It talks about the, you know, meltdowns and everything else and what the problems were, but it never talks about the people. So that's what he hoped to do with Itchy F. So a couple of things in conclusion. We've gone from, you know, this weird, you know, very hopeful, very futuristic, very, you know, positive message to kind of a down and dirty kind of nitty gritty. Here's what we normally see. We went from very high concept to very normal everyday concept. We went from this like exuberance and celebratory nature of, you know, what nuclear power was capable of to reminding everyone what, you know, the power and fear that technology and that particular science comes with. Couple of things to conclude, though. While positives generally outweigh the negatives on this, it only lasted until it came home. Until it hit your backyard, you were positive. And after that, of course, opinion shifted. Oftentimes, the opposition came from a place of personal belief. It didn't necessarily have to be bombastic and terrible and, you know, end of the world. It was very personal for a lot of people, like land grabs. I'm losing my home. I don't want this, you know, to be a part of my life. America, in contrast, kind of relies on the bombastic. You know, it's always end of the world. The planet's going to blow up. The area is going to blow up. The reactor is going to go critical. We always see this even in movies and television, right? While Japan kind of relies more on a personal note. It likes to talk about personal stories. It likes to talk about personal opinions. And, you know, as this technology moves into the future, I feel the debate will continue. But comics, for the most part, for now, have been landed firmly in the anti-nuclear camp, for the most part. There are still some outliers, but those aren't nearly as outspoken as we see the anti-nuclear movements being. And of course, in the immediate views of the current world climate, with different countries starting to posture and starting to move towards a more nuclear world, we're going to start seeing a new surge in comics, and in particularly in popular comics of this subject. We're going to kind of see a resurgence of the stuff. A couple of questions to think about as you kind of leave. Can comics really shift your worldview on nuclear energy, do you think? Or are you all kind of entrenched in your current opinions? As well, you know, think about anything that comics might have had an effect on. It's got a fairly unique perspective in comics. It kind of rides the line of a lot of different aspects. So what do you think comics have done to, like, the movies you've watched, to the television shows you've watched? Has the conversation of nuclear energy affected any of your, like, favorite directors or actors or anything like that? And just something to consider, how have comics actually kind of impacted your life in particular? So thank you for coming.
This has been an episode of WBOI Presents. Special thanks to James Tu for providing the audio for this program. Our theme music is by Mark Waldick. Additional music comes from Mark Waldick and Noah Campodonico. Until next time, thank you for listening.